Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host and spiritual medium, Lady P. No relation to Master P. Today, I'll be channeling the ghost of Anne-Marie Kelly. Say hi, Anne-Marie.
Hello.
It's uncanny, right? Anne-Marie is a classic movie aficionado, and she's also the author of the film experiences A Year with Kate series. Welcome back, Anne-Marie.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us on the podcast, with her no doubt wildly divergent take on the topics we'll be discussing today, is an associate professor in the Film and Television Department at La Sierra University, and the editor and founder of the website ClassicFilmFan.com, Carrie Specht.
Hello, thanks for having me.
On today's show, we're going to talk about the Sight and Sound Critics Poll's 24th greatest film of all time, Rashomon. Listen up to find out if Akira Kurosawa's discourse on truthiness and the corruption of the human soul is worthy of its spot. Then we're going to switch gears and talk about classic Hollywood cinema. This year marks the 75th anniversary of the supposed greatest year in movie history, woo-hoo, 1939. We'll discuss why 1939 is considered such a banner year, and we're each going to talk about some of our personal favorite releases. Then we're going to wrap up the show with our final notes of positivity. All right, ladies, have we got our story straight?
Yes.
Let's do this.
Carriage return.
Remember the old thought experiment? If a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a noise? Well, Akira Kurosawa's 1950 film, Rashomon, rendered that old existential question completely ridiculous, because in Kurosawa's woods, there's always a minimum of 5 people around at any given time. In this world, the question is not whether the tree makes a noise, but whether you can get the 5 observers to agree on what it sounded like. Rashomon is essentially a 12th century courtroom drama. A terrible crime has been committed. A bandit named Tojimaru, if anyone wants to help me out with that pronunciation, go feel free.
I think you did a good job.
Okay. Played by Toshiro Mifune, is accused of raping a woman, played by Michiko Kayo, and murdering her husband, played by Masayuki Mori. At the trial, there are a handful of interested parties that come forward to give their testimony. But the 3 most significant are naturally the bandit, the woman, and the husband, who gives his account through a medium. However, the 3 of them each have a very different recollection of the events of the day. The viewer is tasked with putting all the pieces together and sifting the truth out of the muddle of lies that the witnesses have imparted. At the end of the film, one of the witnesses, who we were led to believe came upon the dead man long after he'd been killed, reveals that he knew more than he initially let on. This witness, a woodcutter, played by Takashi Shimura, apparently saw everything go down. We, the audience, / judge and jury, are meant to believe that the woodcutter's version of the story is the most reliable, but ultimately the truth remains as obscure as the sky in a monsoon. Okay. Ladies? So do you like Rashomon? Let's start with Carrie.
Well, you know what? This is the first time I'd ever seen it.
Okay.
Believe it or not. But yeah, I, of course, know of the film and know of the premise. It's one of those plots that's been used again and again and again in many different films, as well as every, I think, sitcom known to man.
Right.
It just like It's a Wonderful Life plot. It gets used and used and used again. The many different points of view, and then, oh, we find out what really happened in the end. You know, it was a bit of a tough watch for me.
Okay.
I liked the beginning of the film very much. The cinematography is pretty amazing in the beginning. And then it just kind of sits on its laurels towards the end. In the beginning, you've got these amazing camera moves through the forest as you're following the woodcutter in, with and including not only an incredibly long follow tracking shot that cuts across the woodcutter, no pun intended, and comes to his other side and then continues to follow him. And I'm thinking, I don't know what kind of piece of machinery they used, because they're obviously in a real forest. But it was a pretty impressive shot. And it seemed like later in the film, they went to these standardized shots. And, of course, the whole courtroom sequence, there's no court. You're just seeing the people telling their accounts of the story with never seeing a judge or a jury or gathered people.
Right.
You know, you're reading a lot of subtitles. And, yeah, I found myself falling asleep quite a bit during this film. I wonder how much my experience of watching them would be different if, one, I'd seen it while I was in film school 25 years ago, or if I'd seen it in the day that it came out. I believe if I'd seen it when it came out, I probably would have been blown away.
Yeah.
With not only the cinematography and the acting, we're talking 1950 here, but also with the story itself, I would imagine was pretty amazing. But I am going to be one of the ones that question its position.
Okay.
So high on the list.
All right. Anne-Marie, how about you?
This was actually my first time watching it as well, which I feel a little bit guilty about in retrospect.
I'm not alone.
Yeah, no, because I am a big Kurosawa fan too, although I had seen, obviously, I think everybody at this point has seen Seven Samurai, haven't they?
You should.
If you've gone through film school.
Yeah.
It's so like you watch...
Never saw it in film school.
Really?
I don't know where people are exposed. It's too long to watch in a film class.
Not at my film school.
Really?
Not at my film school.
Oh, wow, okay.
Dude, we sat through Lawrence of Arabia. Yeah. Well, some of us did. Anyway.
When the lights came up, there were far fewer students. And there were at the beginning
the story, of class. Isn't that the story of film school? We get less reading, but we have to watch more movies, and the lights come up, and like half the class is gone. Anyway. But most of the Kurosawa that I was familiar with are his Shakespeare adaptations, Throat of Blood, Ran, etc.
Likewise, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I loved. And I was really curious about Rashomon. I think I liked it more than you did. I agree that the cinematography at first is absolutely incredible and felt very, I hesitate to use this word, but modern. Like,
mm-hmm.
It felt
yeah.
a lot like a movie that you would see now, which mm-hmm. for a movie from 1950,
yeah, because it seemed
away.
Like some of those camera moves had to have been CGI, but they mm-hmm. weren't, of course.
Yeah.
They were handheld, actually.
Right.
It was one of the first movies to use handheld extensively, which you think, you know, 1950, nobody
yeah.
did that.
That was probably a pretty heavy camera.
Very heavy camera. Strong cameraman.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I always forget about and then start watching a Kurosawa movie, go, oh, yeah, is that not just the camera movement, but staging. He's incredibly good at staging.
Mm-hmm.
Shots like the discovery of the dead man from the woodcutter, and it's through the hands of the dead man. Or the courtroom scenes where you always have the two men in the back up against this white wall that cuts the top third off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people in the foreground, like this extreme foreground and background, which, again, is not something that you see from a like quote-unquote classical film from the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
It felt, for the time, really different mm-hmm. and really new. I did enjoy it. Toshirô Mifune is great.
Oh, really?
He's amazing.
I love seeing him in everything. It was really fun seeing him, especially after rewatching all of the characters where he's, you know, very serious, to watch him be this like awful, mean little nasty kind of humorous.
Mm-hmm.
he was all over the place with
yeah,
it. Yeah,
on his
wonderful.
Crazy man stuff.
Yeah, yeah. The spitting that he would do before he talked. The
yeah.
I it was, and like you said, you watch it and you go, oh, this is where, you know, so much of our filmography in the last 50 years comes from, is this one movie. Holy cow!
Right. Yeah.
In terms
yeah.
of influence. And I was watching a interview with Robert Altman afterwards, where he talked about seeing the shot of the sunlight through the trees,
right?
Which I guess was one of the first times that got used. And he loved it so much that he walked out on the TV shoot that he was doing the next day and was like, great, guess what, guys? And like pointed the camera up towards the sky. So, yeah, I loved it.
Good. Yeah, I think I echo some of that sentiment. I think it is an undeniably great conceit for film, and it's hard to believe that this was the original, this is where it started, this is the birth of this story structure, or at least the way of telling the story feels so, it was new then. It's
mm-hmm.
remarkable. It's like you said, it's like It's a Wonderful Life. It feels like it's been around forever, but no, it's actually just been around since 1950. But what did you think of the framing device? So the story, I sort of X'd this part out of my intro, but the story starts as three men huddled in the ruins of a temple.
During a torrential rainstorm.
Precisely. Yeah. And it's a flashback within a flashback. So we flash back to the trial, and then we flash back to the crime.
Mm.
Did you guys think that was an effective framing device?
You know, it's so funny. We're so used to that now
mm-hmm.
that it didn't even occur to me that was probably something that was brand new
yeah.
to audiences, the flashback within a flashback. Now it's just used on almost every single film that comes out. Yeah, I mean, the whole film runs very smoothly, very quickly. It's, what, 90 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a quick film. It's very succinct. I'm not sure you could sustain that story structure beyond that, especially with it being only really, what, four or five main characters. You know, I don't know. I just think the problem is I think that the technology and audience sophistication has gotten to a point where the film has lost its impact. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the reason that have that, or that I guess it's a victim of its own success, mm-hmm. that it's been copied so many times that it depletes a little bit from the original. Mm-hmm. If you didn't see it first.
Yeah, I could see that.
But... I could see that. I liked I liked having the framing device to it. There's something like, gosh, there's going to be 7 points of view that get used over the course of it, which I think works well in the favor of the movie in terms of establishing that nobody's telling the truth ever. Mm-hmm. I think you're right that we're maybe at a point where we're so used to this kind of level of sophistication that it doesn't quite have the same impact, but I think the framing device lends it more impact, because if it had just been the trial with the people telling their various stories, which is, you know, something we've seen fairly commonly, the last, I don't know what you call it, twist of learning that even one of the so-called witnesses who's supposed to have absolutely no
there's no vested in it. He's no reason for him to lie.
Yeah, he has no reason to lie, but he lies anyway, and it turns out that framing device gives that one last twist a little bit more extra oomph, and also just gives the audience and I think the characters a chance to breathe in between segments as opposed to running at such a rapid clip. I mean, like you said, it's an hour and a half. It moves along very quickly, but these are these moments of rest to kind of think about what just happened and set up for the next one, kind of preparing the audience for the lies that they're going to keep hearing on top of each other. I do think, now that I think about it, I do think that the only problem that I have with the multiple points of view is that they don't necessarily, they feel a little bit almost like short films, like they don't impact or like layer on top of each other very nicely. They don't build towards anything necessarily, or they don't feel like they are. That would be really my only complaint with it, but like, that's such a small complaint.
And
it's such a new attempt at it. This isn't, you know, what was the movie I was thinking of while I was watching? Oh, Casino. Scorsese's Casino, where everybody is telling different versions of what happened.
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example of the impact that the film has had, the influence. But I think, for me, the framing device is fine. However, at the beginning, when the priest and the woodcutter are going on about the horrible thing that they just witnessed, I didn't quite buy that they would be so shell-shocked.
Yeah, you know, I was expecting something truly horrendous.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, the story itself, like, it's horrendous for the woman.
Well, but... and I guess it's supposed to be more of, because again, taking it from a 2014 point of view, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, was he cut up into little pieces? Was he fed to birds? Yeah. What's this horrific thing? And what it comes down to is really the horror of the fact that so many people were lying. And even more so, more of an impact of the honor and truth of a man forsaking his wife and then not fighting for her, or vice versa, I guess. I think that's what that character is referring to when he says this horrible story.
Right, right.
And what happened is more about the personalities and the lack of honor.
Right, right.
Which is, of course, a huge part of the Japanese culture.
Yeah, and the violence, the one thing, or I guess the two things that don't change is that we know 2 acts of violence happened.
Right.
What changes is the motives for it and the way that they were carried out, which, depending on which character tells it, with the exception of one, and that was the part that kind of confused me, but mostly with each character telling the version that would give them the most honor in the situation. In the bandit's version, it is that, you know, he challenged the man to an honorable duel, and we clashed swords 23 times, and nobody has ever gone above 20 with me. Loved how when he said that.
Yeah.
So he died an honorable death.
He killed him in an honorable way, didn't just slit his throat and run. And in the samurai's version, he killed himself to preserve his own honor. And then the woodcutter's version, they're both just terrible swordsmen and, like, bopping each other. But I think that's a little bit more what it hinges on, is the reasons that people commit what they... or the reasons people do what they do, or the excuses that they even make for themselves for what's happening.
Right, yeah. For me, the subjectivity of the truth, that part of the story is more interesting than the inhumanity of the characters or the loss of their moral fiber. And so the ending where the woodcutter redeems himself to the priest, I guess that's a bit of a spoiler, but I don't think it really, you can still enjoy the movie knowing the ending. Mm-hmm. To me, it felt like a completely separate story and totally besides the point, and it was just sort of dropped in there so that we weren't left feeling totally, you know, despondent after the movie was over. It was just sort of a tacked on happy ending.
Yeah, it was a bit, I thought, a bit odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, partially just because the setup for that happened so late in the story.
Yeah.
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 I was thinking, was there a connection between the two incidences? Is this some sort of outcome?
That would have helped.
The dishonorable act?
Right, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
I was thrown there for a loop, and then it was like, nope, it's just to give them an opportunity to say, there's still hope for mankind.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good to know. I mean, for me, the pleasure of this movie is that we are meant to be impartial observers. So I don't feel emotionally drained after watching it. It's more interesting than heartbreaking mm-hmm. for me.
Mm-hmm. But I'd have to agree. Yeah.
If the film had been about something other than a rape and a murder, do you think it would have been as impactful?
No, I think you needed to have those extreme moments of violence and mm-hmm. yeah, as you said, the stakes had to be high. I mean, let's think about this. As you said, there was a unique framework for the story previously in any kind of trial film, and a lot since. It's always been somewhat of an objective point of view where through either the lawyer or the judge or somebody in the jury, we see things exposed, bits of story exposed, and we're supposed to take all of it to be as fact. And then maybe if it's a Perry Mason thing, there's a twist at the end where somebody didn't quite tell the truth. But of course, I think the whole point of the film is that everything is subjective.
Right. Yeah.
Whatever point of view, your own point of view, you the viewer, your point of view, is very subjective. And that was the first time anybody really said nobody's experiences are the same as anybody else.
Right. Yeah.
I don't care if you're standing right there and you witness the whole thing, you will report it differently than anybody else.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, which I think is a heck of a gutsy move for that kind of film, because I was reading something where somebody was like, well, it's just a ripoff of the Citizen Kane effect. I was like, no, it's really not, because in Citizen Kane you could say, like, in bits and pieces, maybe characters are remembering themselves more nicely than mm-hmm. anything else, but it's painting a very specific and mostly pretty consistent picture of one person. And like I said, other than two acts of violence, pretty much all of the details vary per account in Rashomon. It's not consistent by any means.
Right.
And you're left with the task of sorting out the truth for yourself if you want to. But I don't think it really is the Citizen Kane effect.
Right. No. Well, on our Citizen Kane episode, I did talk about how all the recollections of the various people who are telling Kane's story, they are subjective, and they may not, and the way that the story is told is different. I think Wells did a great job of portraying that. But you're right, it's an extrapolation of that idea,
mm-hmm.
for sure. I don't know, how did you guys feel about the way that the violence was portrayed?
Well, I always appreciate when they're less is more. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that. Well, we don't need to see a bunch of gore and blood or overly sexualized interpretations. It's better to just leave it to the imagination mm-hmm. and read between the lines myself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I would have had a much harder time believing the wife's reactions had we seen the rape on screen. As good as her performance is, it didn't read as true to me. That didn't feel like anything that an actual human being, none of the accounts felt like how an actual human being would react to being raped. But
yeah, the only time you see, or I guess the only setup for the rape that you see, is in the bandit story when he starts kissing her and she resists briefly and then kisses him back, and that's the only like up to that, like up to the rape that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then from then on it's always takes everybody else's account starts right after it happens. And she's also in various states of undress in different versions. Like in the woodcutter's version, she's really like torn up, but in the other ones, she's mostly modest. Yeah, I think that actually kind of affects how you see what may or may not have happened, is because in his version, I hate to say this, in his version, she likes it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is really uncomfortable and awful.
Yeah, but that would also be his point of view.
And it would be absolutely his point of view.
That she really wanted it.
And the samurai's death really does hinge on, I mean, pretty much everything that happens right after that hinges on the wife's reaction to it. Like, she is put in an impossible situation.
Right.
No matter how awful or whatever the samurai's reaction is to it of, like, well, you've been soiled by another man, you are no longer my wife, like, thanks, jerk. But she is put in an impossible situation, and I'm sure in a, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you would feel like you really only have two options.
Right, yeah.
Well, especially in that day and age.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and I that's one of the things I really liked about the story is that it sort of punctures our preconceived notions of about gender attitudes. Initially, she wants to be perceived as a delicate flower and an innocent victim, and she is absolutely an innocent victim, but it is revealed at the end that she is, in fact, a sort of... I don't want to say heroic, but she's not a flower. She has a personality. She has a will of her own.
There's this whole thing about facades,
right? Mm-hmm.
And how we're supposed to perceive each other, and that, well, what's really underneath?
Right.
And this story gives the opportunity for us to see, well, what was really underneath. Just because a guy is dressed as a samurai and looks pretty cool as a samurai does not mean he has the soul of a samurai.
Right.
Or can fight like a samurai.
Right.
Yeah. And just because a woman looks like a beautiful, delicate flower does not mean she's necessarily either very prim and proper or weak.
Yeah. Yeah.
And same with a bandit.
Yeah. A bandit, while he is a monster, he's also kind of a buffoon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
I finally put my finger on what was bugging me about the fact that you only see his version of right before the rape. Do you think the movie's condemning her? Because in the only, we've all said, you don't actually see anything happen, but the only lead up you see is his, where he's clearly saying that she likes it, and everybody else is condemning her afterwards.
Yeah. But it is interesting, even in the woodcutter story, she encourages the bandit and the samurai to kill each other.
Mm-hmm. And that she'll go with the winner.
Right, she's sort of an accomplice in the murder. she's sort of a femme fatale in the end.
Yeah. And at the same time, she's preserving herself.
Right.
Because if she doesn't make that, she makes a good argument.
I think the film has equal disdain for all three characters, but I guess the question is whether we feel she is deserving of the disdain because she is a victim.
Yeah. I see the wheels turning in Anne-Marie's head.
It's so complicated and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Well,
I
was going to say, I just think that I bet people left the theater having these conversations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's very, very complicated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there's some people that probably were uncomfortable with the film would go, well, it's cut and dry, and didn't want to talk about it.
All right. Well, should we ask the final question?
Can I say one more thing before we do?
Yes.
How creepy is the medium?
Way creepy.
Way creepy.
Thought it was the same woman who just moved her eyebrows.
Ah, the creepy medium. But I think it worked really well.
Absolutely.
Because it was like, really a medium? We're going there. But I was like, nope,
I buy it.
That's terrifying. Yep. Nope, you're fine. Continue.
Right. So much of the movie's going for realism. We talked about the handheld camera movements and... You know, there's all these dirty frames, this dirty framing, and then there's the medium part. There's this, in the middle of the movie, there's this supernatural element. Mm-hmm. And it works perfectly, I think.
Yeah. Within context.
Yeah.
Within context, yeah. Out of context, if somebody was walking down the street with a wind machine, I might not believe what it said. But, yeah, in context works fantastic.
All right, well, final question. Is Rashomon worthy of the 24th spot on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll, the 24th greatest movie of all time?
I have to say no.
No. Okay. All right.
That's coming from Carrie. No.
That's coming from Carrie. Carrie says no, Anne-Marie.
What's 25?
Yeah, I want to know what 1 through 23
is. Ties.
Through 1 through 23, there's a bunch of ties?
No, okay. So 23 is... There's a bunch of ties for 23, but Singing in the Rain is 20, and then... There's Godfather, there's Contempt, there's, and I'm missing, La Ventura.
I would put it at number 24, yeah.
Okay. I think I would also put it at number 24. I think the framing device alone, I think the conceit alone merits the spot on...
How many are on the list in all? 100?
250.
250?
Yeah.
I definitely think it should be on the list. Mm-hmm. I think maybe in the top 100.
Okay.
But see, that's how much I think it doesn't deserve to be in 24.
Okay.
I think that's really giving it too much credit.
Okay.
Are any of Akira Kurosawa's films above?
Seven Samurais.
At what? Oh, that's good. Okay. And I'm guessing there are some other of his films after.
Yeah. There are several.
Throne of Blood.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there are several films that are better.
I think Throne of Blood.
Than Rashomon.
All right. Well, I guess we're of a mixed opinion on whether it's merits the 24th spot. But, you know, listeners can tell us what they think. I'm not even going to try to find a decent segue between these topics. We just really felt like talking about this, so here we are. Anyway, 2014 marked the 75th anniversary of what has long been hailed as the greatest year in cinema history, 1939. Just to give listeners a taste of a couple of the movies that were released that year, a little movie called The Wizard of Oz, Stagecoach, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Babes in Arms, Wuthering Heights, Ninotchka, Dark Victory, Young Mr. Lincoln, I feel like I'm missing a big one. Oh, yeah. Gone with the Wind. The movie that is still the highest grossing film of all time when you adjust for inflation. Now, 2014 is almost over, but before it's done, I thought we could just take an opportunity to look back and assess some of the movies from 1939 and gauge how well the 75 years have treated these classics. I know all three of us on this panel are huge movie nerds, with special emphasis on classic Hollywood movie nerdery. So it makes sense that 1939 would have a special place in all of our hearts. But Carrie, 1939 holds a particular fascination for you. Can you talk about why that is?
Well, as you said, it's the greatest film year in film history. A lot of times when people ask why is it the greatest year in film history or why is it considered such, people will just list the movies. And I think you have to think about the fact that it's what made those movies so fantastic. If you look over what was happening in the world at the time, we're just coming out of the Great Depression. The rest of the world is entering war. We're on the brink three years out. And there was a huge push for entertainment. Today, we have all sorts of sources for entertainment, whether it's video games or the internet or what have you. Back then, the main source of entertainment for people was going to the movies. But you've got a burgeoning industry and an art form that has reached a point of figuring out all the problems that it had in its infancy. So making it past the initial stages of just recording plays and or events to stories that then became more sophisticated in both their storytelling, their acting, their editing, their cinematography, everything. And you're talking about I could be wrong, correct me on this, ladies, isn't this also one of the years that had the greatest output of in sheer volume of movies?
Makes sense, yeah.
So when we look at things like Gone with the Wind, I think it's safe to say that Gone with the Wind, please nobody kill me for this, was the avatar of its day.
Mm-hmm. Well,
in the sense that it had new innovations that other films didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
It went the extra step, the extra mile, the extra 100 miles of really producing the greatest film they could possibly produce. And, of course, that was thanks to David O. Selznick.
Mm-hmm. So we would be remiss if we talked about 1939 and didn't mention Gone with the Wind.
Yes, yes.
So I think whether you buy into the story that or the buy into the idea that 1939 is the greatest movie year of all time, I think a lot of that is contingent on you believing that Gone with the Wind is among the greatest movies of all time.
Well,
would you agree?
I don't know if it has to it has to be the flagpole. I mean, yes, people will go to that because everybody, even to my students today, I say, mention films from 1939. And people know Gone with the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, most of them know Wizard of Oz, but everybody knows Gone with the Wind. On my website for Classic Film, I do have a page dedicated for reviews just for 1939. I like to talk about why, where, when, who made these films happen. And a lot of times you're talking about some amazing talents that just whether it was from the production designer Cameron Menzies or the producer David O. Selznick or the three directors that worked on the film. You're talking Victor Fleming and George Cukor, and I can't remember who was the third guy who gets some credit. Somebody that we've all forgotten.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the amazing talents of not just the leads but all of the supporting actors in this film. So, and I think that that was a huge contribution, is you've got this amazing stable of talent, both in, behind the camera and in front of the camera, that is pretty unbeatable. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about a day and age before CGI, so people had to come up with solutions to make a believable tornado in Kansas.
Right.
What do? Well, you get a woman's stocking and you blow air through it.
Every time I watch it, I'm like, is it animation? It's a woman's stocking.
It's a woman's stocking.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, exactly. And nowadays, people would spend months and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, to create the same effect with a computer.
And it'll still look fake.
Yeah
exactly.
One of the things that I love about 1939 that kind of blows me away is how immediately everybody knew that this was the big year. Like, almost from the get-go, it was like, 39 is amazing, guys. And I think that partially has to do with how bad 38 was.
Really?
No, really. It was... Okay, so 1938 was the year of the...
You can't take it with you, won the Academy Award.
Right. True, which your mileage may vary on that one. But it was a really bad year for the industry in terms of ticket sales. Mm. It was actually so bad that they started up a campaign called... movies are your best entertainment, which somebody pointed out the acronym was actually maybe. Whoops. And they were having so much trouble getting people into theaters. They were trying this like ticket campaign of like, if you...
Is that when they started giving away dishes and stuff like that?
Yeah. And when there was a subscription thing where you could go to a certain number of movies and like write your own reviews, and at the end there was a prize, and like only a couple thousand people participated, like turned all of this stuff
in. Because they just didn't care?
Yeah, because they couldn't get people in. And part of it was that a lot of the movies on this list were not particularly good. Mm-hmm. But it also just was a nasty year. It was the year that the Box Office Poison article came out, Wake Up Hollywood, that listed Katherine Hepburn, Mae West, Joan Crawford, Kay Francis, etc., as box office poison. And that's because ticket sales were down and they needed a scapegoat.
So they blame the actresses.
Yeah, I didn't notice any men's names on that list.
Actually, hold on. I have the list right here. I wrote about this extensively. There is a guy's list. There are men's name on Edward Arnold.
Poor Eddie
Edward Arnold.
Yeah. No, it was a vicious article, but it was the reason for it. It was actually an ad in The Hollywood Reporter. But the reason for it was because ticket sales were down and they needed somebody to blame. And since the studio system at that time was set up as much as anything to get people, like you were saying, get people in to see actors as opposed to now where it's to get people in to see franchises.
Right.
It would be the equivalent of somebody putting out an ad like, Marvel, stop making Guardians of the Galaxy movies. Yeah. They're all terrible and nobody will go to see them. Except we all know that's not true.
Well, and I guess this also was an attempt to say, wait, we know you haven't been happy, so we're going to get rid of the old stock and bring in some new stock. Maybe.
Yeah. And so I think having that kind of dip, I mean, it was the year that ruined for 2 years, Katherine Hepburn's career.
Right.
Shameless plug.
Yes, but we got Philadelphia Story out
of
it.
Oh, boy, did we ever.
And, well, 1938, that was Bringing Up Baby.
That was Bringing Up Baby and Holiday.
I hate that film. I hate Bringing Up Baby.
Like Holiday?
I do.
Okay,
I do like
so
Holiday.
It was Bringing Up Baby and Holiday. Actually, this is my favorite part about that. In 1938, when Holiday came out, it was a Columbia picture, and they needed people to come to it so badly that they started putting up ads that said, is it true what they say about Miss Hepburn? But nobody showed up.
Oh, no.
So I guess the answer was yes. No, but what I love about 1939 is in the context of 1938 was so bad that immediately when like all of these great films started being released and people started going back to the theaters, like you said, Gone with the Wind is still one of the highest grossing movies of all time. Certainly the highest ticket sales of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And likely to always be. The ticket numbers are so outrageously through the moon and back.
It's probably the only case I know of Hollywood patting its back and being like, yeah, this is great, and everybody continuing to say so for the next 75 years.
Right.
Everybody agrees with them.
Yeah.
Well, I think you also bring a good point about, while you were talking, it made me realize that we did a switchover in about 1939 where we stopped making those silly screwball comedies in the truest form of screwball comedy that was set in like elitist upper class silly women doing silly things with lots of money.
It was the year of the women.
I was about to say it was the year of the women.
But it was that's not a screwball comedy.
That's true.
I'm talking, it's like up to then, it seemed like everybody, every female actress had some comedy that she was in where she was some rich, spoiled, upper crust gal with lots of more money than she knew what to do with. And it was always some man who was a man of the people who would bring her back around somehow to realizing what the best things in life were. And that worked early on in the Depression because people wanted that escapism. But later in the Depression, I think where people were just tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, we're tired of seeing these rich people having fun.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see something else. And that something else ended up being just better stories, more diversity,
yeah.
more plot lines.
Yeah. Yeah. There is such a wide variety. People cite all these movies, but Young Mr. Lincoln and Dark Victory are very different films.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah.
Stagecoached, completely Stagecoach. Different from, say, you know, Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
I don't like Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Oh, see, those are fighting words. Love that.
Can we think of any common themes among the movies? Is there anything
of 1939?
Yeah, or is it all just a disparate bunch?
I don't know.
Bunch?
I think the point is that they did anything and everything.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, too, at this point of the Depression and the pre-war years, they were churning these movies out. I think Hollywood had every intention of continuing that, like whatever the number of films they put out that year. I think they thought they were going to put out more the next year and more the next year and more the next year because the movie theaters were putting turnover, what, every week, every mm-hmm. 2 weeks? My grandmother was 15 in 1939, and she used to go to the movies twice a week with one, I think her grandmother to one movie theater in town, her aunt to the other one, dressed to the nines, hat and gloves, and it was something different at both either theater, and it's something different every week. You know, that's how many movies they were putting out all the time. And they had a huge choice of films.
So can I tell you my two favorite stories about movie going in 1939?
Sure.
Because they're both my grandmother.
How old was she?
My grandmother was in her teens. And she had just met my grandfather. And they went to see Gone with the Wind. They get to intermission with God as my witness, I'll never go hungry again. That was lovely. And left. Because they didn't know. They thought the movie was over. So they missed the entire second half of Gone with the Wind.
That's funny.
The other one was that she was babysitting my cousin Bob, who's like my second cousin. And he was really little, but his favorite book was The Wizard of Oz. So he made her sit through, because this was the period of time where you buy a movie ticket and you could stay in the theater as long as you wanted. He made her sit through three showings of The Wizard of Oz because he was waiting for the hammerheads from the book who aren't in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And he was convinced if they just watched it the next time. So needless to say, I did not watch The Wizard of Oz with my grandmother when I was little.
She'd had enough.
She'd had enough.
The first time around. It's funny.
So, I mean, 1940 was also a really good year.
True.
Spillover.
Yeah. It was just spillover. Is that right? Yeah. Fair enough. But we have Rebecca won Best Picture. The Grapes of Wrath, Philadelphia Story, The Letter, The Great Dictator, His Girl Friday.
Love that movie.
Which I love.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you think that 1939 is worthy of the hype?
Yeah, I would say so. I think some people have tried to present some arguments about this is a year in late 60s.
67, 68.
And also in the early 70s, I want to say like 74 or something like that. I'd have to sit down and look at them myself. I haven't done that. But I think it is worth the hype because it was a culmination of a perfect storm of the industry growing up, the mechanics being played out, the talent coming together, the organization.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of people who have a lot of bad things to say about the studio system, but the studio system, if it hadn't existed, we would not have had 1939.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It played itself out to the point that we didn't need the studio system anymore. The industry outgrew that. But it was definitely necessary to make 1939 happen.
Right. And they were all competing with each other. They all had to mm-hmm. up their game. Right?
Yeah. I think as far as the best year for studio system films, yeah, absolutely 39. It's okay. Got every single genre that the studio system did best and then some.
It's yeah. true. Though I would say 1950 was pretty solid. Just as a personal. For the 1-2 punch, you got All About Even, Sunset Boulevard.
But I think
And you know, Rashomon's pretty good.
In sheer volume.
Though. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. On average, 1939 is pretty great.
Kicks butt.
Yeah, mm-hmm. totally does. But so what are some of your favorites?
Oh, gosh.
You have to pick one.
skip to Anne Marie while I pull up mine. For real? Gone with the Wind?
I do really love Gone with the Wind. Yeah. Okay, it's not the one I want to pick, but I do want to say one quick note about the reason that I love Gone with the Wind, which is actually to do with the fact that it was shot in Technicolor and how it was shot in Technicolor. Because if you look at Wizard of Oz, which was also a Technicolor movie shot in the same time, you've got one which Wizard of Oz is very flatly shot. It's all very bright lights and just on screen. Gone with the Wind has these great shadowy effects. It has like the women praying with their shadows up on a wall. Mm-hmm. It's got the blinds against her eyes. It's got Rhett dragging her up the stairs. Mm-hmm. It is shot beautifully. It is shot cinematically, like so few Technicolor movies had been up until that point. It was hugely influential in that way for how color the good Technicolor films were made afterwards. But actually, my favorite movie from 1939 is The Women.
Okay, The Women. Do tell. Why is that?
I have watched it probably once a year since I discovered it in high school. But the reason for it is because I originally just thought it was a fun, catty, you know, women-driven comedy. But it actually has a lot going on to it. I rewatched it at the TCM Classic Film Festival this year because they showed it for its 75th anniversary. And I realized halfway through that, in theory, it is a movie about, you know, remarriage. It is a movie about a woman truly in love with her husband, coming back, winning him back, and preserving the sanctity of marriage. Except that what happens to Norma Shearer's character, losing her husband to Joan Crawford, to lower-class perfume girl Joan Crawford, happens to Rosalind Russell's character, too. Rosalind Russell loses her husband to a lower-class woman who is played brilliantly by Paulette Goddard, who freely admits she does not love her soon-to-be husband. But we're supposed to be okay with that because Paulette Goddard's nicer than Rosalind Russell. Like, it's got these little bits of subversive things going on, basically saying, because it was written by Claire Booth Luce. The original play was written by Claire Booth Luce, who actually ended up becoming a U.S. senator. No, a representative, a congresswoman. Oh. But the screenplay was written by Anita Luce, who did Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, the play.
And the Luce is spelled differently on the
Yeah,
play.
L-O-O-S is Anita Luce. And so
no
it's
relation.
Yeah. No relation, yes. So it's actually this sneaky little subversive comedy that you could totally watch it and be like, yes, it's about the course of true love. But no, it's really about how marriage is an institution and a job for these very high society, very mean women.
And it also boasts the greatest bathtub ever.
Oh my gosh, that bathtub is amazing.
Best bathtub.
And did you guys know that even the animals they used were women?
Women, yeah. They went, Cougar went like all female. Full bore with it. There are no men in the entire thing.
He commits. So yeah. Two Cougars for your favorites. Right?
Yeah, although the reasons that I love Gone with the Wind have absolutely nothing to do with the acting, which is arguably the only thing Cougar really influenced in it.
Well, I love the acting in Gone with the Wind.
Oh, I do love the acting in it, but it's not the reason.
I'm not a fan of Gone with the Wind, I gotta say.
That's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, we have spoken of this before, and I guess I shall not speak of it again.
Well, you can, but Gone with the Wind is on the list, so there will be another opportunity to talk about it.
Ah, okay, so we'll save that for another time. Some of my favorites, and if you go to my website, Classic Film Fan, and you go to the review page for 1939, I think I have 30 reviews there, maybe more. But I think I started out with my favorites first, and I just opened up my page to see what they were. And I started out with Goodbye, Mr. Chips, which I understand Emery does not like.
It's okay. I really like Greer Garson in it.
I love Greer Garson. I love also Robert Donut. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people don't appreciate Robert Donut, who plays Mr. Chips, because they see him in this film first. What people don't realize is he was a huge matinee idol. He was the man in The 39 Steps, that gorgeous, hunky star. That's him. Hmm. And now he's playing this dweeby English teacher in a private school. And this is why he beat out Clark Gable for Best Actor of 1939, because he was playing so against type. And they're like, oh my gosh, what happened to our gorgeous, thick-haired hero of thrillers? And he's playing this role. So I love that film. It's a little long, but I still love it. It's one of those films where it may be too long for other people, but you're glad it's that long when you watch it. Also, Gunga Din. It's a huge favorite of mine. It wasn't nominated for Best Picture, like many of the other films. There were 10 nominated that year. But Gunga Din is often played along with the Best Picture nominees whenever they do retrospectives, because it's so popular. And, you know, you've got Victor McLaughlin and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and Cary Grant in this wonderful action-adventure film that basically influenced Raiders of the Ark, Lost Ark in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I could go on and on about my favorites, but I'd like to hear yours.
Well, yeah. I think my favorite has to be Gone with the Wind. You know, it's the sentimental favorite. I'm not sure if I'm even allowed to, like, there's so many reasons why I shouldn't like Gone with the Wind. It's completely politically incorrect.
In so many ways.
In many ways. But I love Vivien Leigh's performance. I love Clark Gable. I love all the performances. It's gorgeous. And I think that the message, the story of the film really, I think that's the perfect movie for to be emblematic of that year. That because it is about the end of an era. Mm. And in many ways, 1939 is, I mean, it's sort of, it's more the beginning of something than the end of something.
Well, you could say there's an argument for both.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I guess when something begins, another thing is ending,
exactly.
Right? So I think that's kind of the perfect movie to symbolize this that year. Not to mention, it's the biggest movie of that year, the biggest movie of all time. And I remember seeing it when I was, I think, in middle school, and it's still captivating. It's
did you see it on
gorgeous.
TV, or how did you
I
see it?
I saw it at my parents' television. Not the ideal way to watch
like
it.
VHS or DVD?
Probably. I don't remember if it was VHS or DVD, but I loved it. I thought I was so blown away by Vivien Leigh.
Yeah.
And I was not prepared for it. And now looking back on, I think I found her probably a little too sympathetic. Like she's a pretty terrible person. But embodied her with so much strength.
That's my biggest problem with the film is that it's basically says if you're pretty, then you can get away with being a despicable
person. Well, I think that was
and smart.
Yeah. I think that was the key, was that she wasn't sentimental about the loss of the Great South.
Or her first husband.
Or any of her husbands.
Or her second husband.
Yeah. And I think that was something I really responded to. She embodied the strong, independent woman. Unfortunately, sometimes that strong, independent woman could be kind of selfish.
Oh, Ashley.
and weirdly sentimental. It's like all the sentimentality was wrapped up in that Ashley character. I think it's so brilliantly done.
I can't stand Ashley. I don't actually like Leslie Howard, with two exceptions.
Yeah. Which are what?
The Scarlet Pimpernel and Pygmalion.
Hmm. But I do think he was the perfect person to play Ashley. Like, he's like, obviously, you're supposed to root for Clark Gable. She's supposed to be with Clark Gable. He's sort of this dweeby, you know, he's someone who couldn't adapt to the times.
That's true.
And so I think he's sort of a relic, and I think he plays that perfectly. but because we don't want to focus too much on Gone with the Wind, because mm-hmm. that's coming up at a later date, I do want to say one of my other favorite movies from 1939 is Ninotchka.
Yeah.
The collaboration between Ernst Lubitsch and Billy Wilder, one of Garbo's last performances. But mm-hmm. I love that this movie is, you know, it's about all that is good about free commerce. And individual freedom is embodied by a very, very silly hat. That is just the sentiment I can get behind, you know?
Oh, and I just want to stress Melvin Douglas's performances in this film. It was supposed to be Cary Grant. And for whatever reason, Grant couldn't do it. He was doing something else or something. And Melvin Douglas was the one that did it. And although I can close my eyes and see Grant doing it, I really do think this is a situation where Melvin Douglas did the better performance.
Yeah.
I mean, I know it's set in Paris, but I think it's really a clash of the U.S. values versus Russian values.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah,
and so I think it's better to have that Melvin Douglas. He's more of an American everyman kind of thing.
That line when she says, must you flirt? Yes, I don't have to, but I find it comes natural.
Oh, man. I love that movie so much. In general, I love movies that, like, play on or at least are incredibly aware of their stars' images, and that one so perfectly nails Garbo's mm-hmm, image. Mm-hmm. And she's clearly having so much fun poking fun at herself.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also, apparently, Greta Garbo and Lubitsch had a really great relationship.
She really respected
him. Mm-hmm. So I think she did more. He got more out of her because of that relationship.
Yeah.
So any final thoughts on 1939 before we bid it adieu for another 5 years?
Just want to point out that it was also the year of Son of Frankenstein,
okay.
Which is notable because it has Basil Rathbone playing Son of Frankenstein, the doctor. It also has Boris Karloff playing the monster, and it has Bela Lugosi as Igor. I mean, that is a great film. And that film is what Mel Brooks based Young Frankenstein on. So it's definitely worth seeing.
It's the year of one of the first Sherlock Holmes movies. Yeah,
both
with
first two Sherlock Holmes films.
Which are amazing.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, as well as, I believe, The Hound of the Baskervilles, which is considered better.
Basil Rathbone is my Sherlock.
Mine too? Absolutely. Yeah.
Brandy Pants Cumberbatch is totally fine, but Basil Rathbone is my Sherlock.
All right. Well, on that note, I guess we'll catch up with these at their 80th birthday. We've come to the end of another episode, but fear not, after all, tomorrow is another day.
Why did we not see that coming?
I don't know. I feel bad that I didn't work in more with the wind comments now.
But to tide you over, here's a couple of final notes of positivity. Anne-Marie, share with us one piece of culture that you've been enjoying lately.
I have been way behind on my movie watching this week because I've been working my way through the Amazon Prime series Transparent.
Ah, yes.
It's a TV show about a trans woman coming out to her kids. The woman's played by Jeffrey Tambor. A sensitive, sweet portrait. But what's really blowing my mind about it is that this is a TV in quotes, this is a show that would not ever be on cable networks. It wouldn't be on any network. To a certain degree, Orange is the New Black or House of Cards, with some edits, with some changes, absolutely could end up on like an HBO.
Certainly House of Cards.
Yeah, or yeah. A Showtime. But this is truly the first show that I've watched where I've said, no, this is what the web can do that we haven't yet gotten on network television, on cable television yet.
Yeah.
And in terms of story structure, in terms of how long it allows its characters to build, just in terms of visual aesthetics, it's a very anti-glamorous film. Not film. Anti-glamorous TV series. So I'm really glad that it exists. I think people should check it all out. Also, for people who live in LA, it's great because it's all shot in LA and it's very LA specific, so that they keep throwing in these great jokes. My favorite was at one point, one of the people gets mad. It's like, it's not like I live in Venice. You can see me whenever you want. And I died because nobody drives to Venice. But I'm really excited. It's one of those shows that makes me really excited about what the future of show, I don't want to call it television because it's not television, but what the future of what we now right now think of as television is.
Right.
Yeah.
I had a very similar reaction. Like, this doesn't look like a television show. Check that out. I second that endorsement. Carrie, how about you?
Wow. I've been kind of busy lately. I haven't been able to keep up with all of my film watching that I'd like to do in regards to not just what's coming out lately, but old films. I mean, it's one of the things I love to say to my students is that tell me the film that you like, and I'm going to help expose you to a whole bunch of other films like that that you didn't even know existed. So you don't have to sit and wait for the next Transformers to come out or something. Believe it or not, I can find something like Transformers.
But I'm fascinated. What's like Transformers?
Ooh, yeah, shoot, I shouldn't have said that. No. But I can usually sit down and figure out, okay, what kind of films does this kid like? And I can then make a list for them and say, look, all these films exist and you probably won't get through them in your lifetime. I've been trying to let my students know about these other resources of culture, whether it's going to their local movie theaters, which, believe it or not, guys, there's a lot of local movie theaters that show classics either on the weekends or ongoing. And it isn't just, you know, a place like The Egyptian, which is wonderful, but mainstream theaters out in Riverside, believe it or not. I can't believe it. And they usually have discount rates, and they're all over the place. And, of course, almost every museum.
So I guess your note of positivity is go see...
Well, look back to go forward.
Yeah. I like
movies
it.
Movies are your best entertainment.
Maybe. So, mine is Veronica Mars. It's a show that's been making some headlines this year because they recently made a Veronica Mars movie, which was funded in large part through crowdsourcing. I remember watching it when it was on at the time, as it was airing. And now with all the hype surrounding the movie, I thought I'd go back and revisit. Plus, I recently got Amazon Prime. It's on there. It's all very exciting. Many have compared the show to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, to which I say, bitch, please. No way.
Joss Whedon's on it, though.
He is, yes, as is Charisma Carpenter and Allison Hannigan. But it has a lot of snappy dialogue, and it's a show overall that I'm really digging. But the reason I wanted to bring it up is because it's the penultimate episode of the first season is a really great reinterpretation of the Rashomon story structure.
Is that right? Yeah, it is.
So our main character, we learn early in the season, was raped at a party. And on this penultimate episode, she talks to multiple people about the events surrounding the party where she was raped. And we get multiple variations on the events of the evening. And ultimately, unlike Rashomon, we get some version of the truth.
Have you seen Play It Again, Dick?
No, I have not. That is the new spin-off series,
right? Yeah, they're doing a 5-minute webisodes versions of... It's really meta because it's the actors playing the characters. It's great.
Okay.
Team Mac all the way, anyway.
But anyway, I think this is the perfect illustration of the lasting influence of Rashomon. There we go. And that's the way we frame it. Flixwise, that is. Listeners, what's your favorite movie from 1939? Come tell us about it on our show page, flixwise.com, or you can leave us a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/flixwise. And while you're at it, you might as well follow us on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But most important of all, please rate and leave us a nice message on iTunes. Help us stand out in their database and let other classic movie fans know who we are. On the next episode, we're going to have a special listener submission to the Flixwise Favorites list. Here's a hint, it's Christmas themed. In the meantime, Carrie, it's been lovely having you on again.
Thanks, great to be here.
Anne-Marie, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Come back, both of you. Don't make me affect a southern accent and beg.
We won't do that.
Well, but I got what shall I do?
Miss Dallas.
All right, guys, take care.